Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. In late October of 1517, a priest and theologian in the town of Wittenberg, Germany, nailed a series of debating points and challenges to a number of practices of the Roman Catholic Church, including the sale of indulgences. The 95 Theses, as they became known, launched a cascade of events that led to a watershed rupture in the institutional structure of Western Christianity. And while Martin Luther and the subsequent Protestant Reformation that he gave birth to was not the only challenge to the organizational and doctrinal structure of the Roman Church, it certainly had the greatest and most lasting impact. Why did Luther's challenge result in such a major schism within the Church, whereas earlier reform efforts were not as successful? How did the Reformation spread so rapidly, by historic standards, throughout Central and Western Europe? And why did some cities and regions break away from the hegemony of Rome while others remained committed to Catholicism? To discuss these matters and more, I am joined today by Stephen Pfaff, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Washington and non-resident scholar at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion. Professor Pfaff is author of numerous articles on religion and historical sociology, ranging in topics from the organization of Islam in contemporary Europe to maritime mutinies in England during the 18th century. I got to give an arg out for that one there. Steve is also the author of an award-winning book on the collapse of the Berlin Wall entitled Exit Voice Dynamics and the Collapse of East Germany. We'll provide a link to that book on our website, and I encourage listeners to get it and read it. It's a fascinating read. But today we want to talk about Steve's research in conjunction with Hyo-Jung Kim at Cal State University in Los Angeles on the Reformation and the novel and convincing thesis that they have regarding the spread of the Reformation and how it owed a great deal to groups of inspired university students. Welcome to Research on Religion, Steve.
It's a pleasure to join you, Tony.
Before discussing the causes and reasons for the spread of the Protestant Reformation, I want to examine that term, Protestant Reformation, because you don't necessarily use that term, Protestant Reformation, and you have a footnote in the paper that I found fascinating. Read footnotes in papers because you find a lot of fascinating information in these, that relates to that term, Protestant Reformation. So let me ask you first, where did the term Protestant come from? Was that a term coined by Luther and his followers?
No, they called themselves evangelicals. The term Protestant was a pejorative term used against them following a diet, an imperial council, in the city of Speyer in 1529. The evangelical camp objected to the resolutions of this diet. This objection was called a protestation, and then afterwards, those who were associated with the evangelical camp were called Protestants because of this protestation.
And the term Reformation, too, that is a term that comes out of the word reform. And many scholars, including Rodney Stark at Baylor, who has written about this in For the Glory of God, would call this more of a schism. And I think in the time of 1517, they didn't know that this was going to be a schism. But if you could address that term Reformation a little bit more for
That's
us.
That's right. So certainly it was not in Luther, Bucer, Zwingli, Melanchthon, other leaders of the early evangelical movement certainly were not revolutionaries in the sense that they were not trying to overthrow Western Christendom. And initially they were not trying to overthrow even the authority of Rome or destroy the universal church in the West. Really what they were trying to do was to reform the church back to its original principles as they understood them, back to the principles of apostolic Christianity, and make its practices and teachings more in line with scriptural sources. So no, they didn't really wish to break with the church originally. They really wanted to reform the church. Now they weren't alone in this. Many people in the church thought reforms were necessary. They were probably more radical than many in their diagnosis of how great the problems were and in their insistence on the urgency of reform. But that's right. They certainly didn't initially want to break away from the church entirely, or to create new churches. That is to say, new institutional churches on different authority.
And in many ways, this reflects the history of Protestantism afterwards. There have been a great many schisms that don't necessarily start as a breakaway sect. You can think of what became known as the Puritans in the Church of England. They thought of themselves as a reform movement as well, but it eventually becomes a schism, which is interesting.
Yes, and I think that there's a tendency toward fissiparity in their thinking, in part because since they stressed the authority of the original scriptures over worldly authorities, and because they said that every honest Christian could interpret the Gospels for himself or herself, that meant that there was no greater authority really than Scripture and conscience. So after that, it was very difficult to say that any worldly power, be that the state or be that the Pope or be that any other kind of human, as they would see it, human instituted authority, had the right to really make a once and for all determination about what was scripturally appropriate or how the church should be organized.
Right. Well, let's go back to the Protestant Reformation of Luther time, and actually maybe a little bit further. We tend to think of Luther as initiating the big break, so to speak, with the Roman Catholic Church. But he wasn't the first challenge out there, was he?
No, and in fact, we should be careful when we even, you know, in this phase that I'm most interested in, the first couple decades after 1517, it's even a little bit misleading to speak of the Reformation because, you know, looking back, we can see that as an event with these monumental consequences. But that wasn't clear in the beginning at all, and there was no centrally directed Reformation movement. There was no central Reformation project. All that emerged over time as a result of interactions between the various evangelical groups and their opponents, and between evangelical groups and their supporters. So, yeah, we should be very careful in that regard. Yeah, and also we should recall that Luther was not the first one to argue for fundamental reforms in the Western Church. There had been many movements of this kind, and you know, historians of religion have documented these very thoroughly. But two, I think, are really important, and that is in the 14th century, that of John Wycliffe and his followers, who were called the Lollards.
The Lollards, right?
And in the 15th century, the Czech priest Jan Hus and his followers, who became known as Husites. These were very important movements that were calling for many of the same sort of objections that Luther and Zwingli had in the 16th century. But these movements either were eventually crushed or were much more limited in their impact than was the case with the German Reformation of the 16th century.
It seems to be an ongoing part of Christian history where there are these revitalizations or reform movements that go on. And as you mentioned, Jan Hus and John Wycliffe and the Lollards were quintessential examples of this. But you know, throughout Christian history, even dating before the Constantine Declaration, the Edict of Nantes, you had disagreements within the church about what the true church really represented. What's interesting about the Protestant Reformation or the Evangelical Reformation or Luther's break is really that it happened and that 1517 becomes a watershed year. And so, you know, we want to kind of talk about why then, why in the early 16th century and why in what you call in your paper Central Europe, which you refer to as the Holy Roman Empire at the time. Sometimes we think of Germany as being part of Western Europe now, but take a look at a map back then, and, you know, part of the Holy Roman Empire in Central Europe. So why then and why there? What are the dominant explanations for why this Reformation occurs then and there?
We're very lucky. You know, sociologists like me and Professor Kim are very lucky because there's already an extraordinary historiography on the origins of the Reformation and on the social and political transformations that were occurring in the beginning of the 16th century. So why that time and why that place? Those are good questions. Why that time? Well, for one thing, there had been enormous commercial expansion in Europe prior to 1517. Towns were increasing in size and clout. There was much more trade. There was a growing class of ambitious burghers, you know, townsmen who were involved in proto-manufacturing and trade, and often wanted a kind of a greater independence.
And let me stop you right there and talk about this the growing trade that is occurring here. When I use the term Holy Roman Empire, that term empire makes it sound as if it's a monolithic entity controlled by a single ruler. Was that the case in the early 16th century?
Yeah, the Holy Roman Empire, the German nation, was hardly what we think of as a highly unified national state or even a highly unified absolutist state, as we might think about England or France in the coming centuries. Rather, it was a kind of loose confederation of principalities, ecclesiastical states ruled by prince bishops, city-states that were independent city-states, petty regimes ruled by little princes, and also holdings of the imperial dynasty, the Habsburg family itself. And this was an enormous territory stretching from present-day Belgium, the Netherlands in the west, to the borders of the frontiers of Hungary in the southeast, and incorporating much of present-day Germany, parts of Poland, parts of basically the Czech Republic, most of northern Italy, Austria, a little bit of France. So a really huge and diverse territory. And one of the things that I think most historians would agree, and most sociologists who've pursued this as well would argue, is that why there in part? Well, because there was no effective central political organization which could, in alliance with the church, readily crush a well-organized and broadly spread movement like the evangelical movement. Various princes had different political interests than either that of the Habsburg emperor or the pope, and so it wasn't always easy for either the pope or the emperor or an alliance to exert their will in these diverse territories of the empire. Some city-states were very sympathetic to the cause for evangelical reform. Some princes were sympathetic to those calls. So this provided a kind of political opportunity for reform that was really not present earlier or very widely.
And that's really interesting. One of the interesting aspects of your paper is that you pick up this variation that, you know, we think of the Holy Roman Empire as a monolithic entity, and it certainly wasn't. And we think of the Protestant Reformation as a monolithic wave that washes over Europe, and that's not the case as well. It seems to have occurred some places here, some places there, but not there and not here. And that provides you a lot of interesting variation to discuss. So, okay, and sorry for getting sidetracked on that, but let's go back to some of these structural factors that we were talking about, as, you know, thinking about the clues to what we were trying to figure out why here and why there. We talked about the rise of increased trade and proto-capitalism, and how does that play out in some of these theories?
Well, for example, and you know, part of increased rise in trade and increased capitalist activity is also related to another factor, which is considered a very important one, which I think many people are familiar with, which is the rise of print capitalism. Mm-hmm. So the printing press had been invented at the end of the 15th century, and by the early 16th century, there was already a flourishing print capitalism. And in the Holy Roman Empire, there were presses in around 80 towns, which was quite a lot. And there were far greater number of presses in the Holy Roman Empire than was the case, let's say, in France or England or in Italy, in part because it was harder for central authorities to impose limits on the establishment of presses. So there were a far greater number of presses.
And that's really interesting. We're starting to see this fragmentation have its fingerprints on a number of different causes, not only in the trade and the rise of a burgher class that's separate from the princes, but also, you know, the fact that you can't shut down a printing press. And this becomes a big part of the story, does it not?
That's right. So this region, Central Europe, is characterized by a degree of political and cultural and economic pluralism that is unusual in Europe at that time. And I think it's one of the reasons why it was the cradle of this reform movement.
Let me ask a little bit more about the printing press, because I know you and I have discussed this before. But, you know, when you think about medieval Europe and your images of this, there couldn't be a lot of literate peasants or so. But, you know, to what extent did the press really get around? What did the pamphlets and such, did these things really get around or what?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, there's been some really fantastic work done in recent decades on the printing press, and even, as the eminent historian Mark Edwards puts it, the print propaganda campaign of Luther and his followers. So we don't really know how widely spread literacy was, but we know that there had been incredible increase in schooling. So in many towns and cities had established schools to improve general education, you know, not of everyone, but of probably of what we would consider the upper middle classes.
Right.
And in addition to that, there was a great interest in reading. So we know even that some artisans became literate. So it's estimated, you know, the estimates vary, but probably around a fifth of the male urban residents in the Holy Roman Empire were literate.
And that's pretty amazing to think about when you think about the level of technology at the time and our images of the of Europe at this moment in time. I mean, I guess also the printing press, we think about now the spread of the internet age and that. And, I mean, this was equivalent to the spread of the internet. It's just a major technological innovation that really gives rise to new forms of collective action, new forms of literate individuals that and ways that they can spread their ideas. And I think that's a big part of what your thesis here. And before we get to that, though, one other aspect I want to talk about, too, one of these structural factors. Could you address the financial matters related to the Roman Catholic Church and how that related to secular principalities and how that might have affected the spread of this evangelical protest movement?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So previous scholars like Rodney Stark and Guy Swanson and Mary Fulbrook have pointed out that we usually think of that there being a single set of economic relationships between the princes or the kings and the church. But in fact, there were a variety of different arrangements made. Depending on the relative clout that the church versus a prince had in a territory, different kinds of arrangements could be made in terms of the sharing of ecclesiastical revenues, of religious tithes, of other sources of income, like the income from indulgences or other sorts of, as they were sometimes called, clerical extractions. So some princes had relatively, you know, relatively favorable arrangements with the church where they got to keep a large proportion of those revenues which were generated. Other princes had much less favorable ones. Also, many cities resented this because the clergy were exempt from civil taxation. So if you had a lot of priests or monks and nuns in your town, that really decreased the tax base that was available to these to these autonomous townsmen. And also, not only that their incomes couldn't be taxed, but their properties could not be taxed as well.
Right.
So often the church, through its various organizations, owned a substantial part of urban real estate, but actually paid no taxes. The same thing was true about the clerical incomes themselves. So this was a source of real frustration in the towns. So some princes in the Holy Roman Empire, and many of these townsmen, were angered by this situation and had long been trying to gain greater control over ecclesiastical matters, gain a better share of the revenues generated by these kind of different kinds of revenue generating mechanisms. So this was another factor, I think, that created an incentive for rulers to take up the issue of reform.
And that brings me up to your thesis. What we've done here is we've laid the framework, the larger structural factors, the rise of capitalism, the printing press, increased trade, people moving between towns and such, as well as these financial concerns that we just talked about. Those are great, and they all set in place the environment for, as you mentioned before, this unique environment for Protestantism or evangelicalism to flourish at this point in time. But one of the things that I really like about your work is how you get down to the micro sociological details of this, that just because there's a printing press doesn't mean Protestantism naturally explodes. There has to be people that promote this. And obviously everybody's attention turns to Luther and later on Zwingli and Calvin perhaps, but these are one single individuals, very impressive individuals of you know, great historical importance, but they probably can't do it alone. And so the big question becomes is, how does this movement grow at the grassroots?
Yeah, that's the heart of the matter. Nothing I've said so far about explanations about why the Reformation occurred or the precursors to the Reformation, nothing I've said about that is novel. These things are all really well known. But what Professor Kim and I noticed was that there are some puzzles. So for example, if it's true that it was princely incentives or political incentives that drove support for reform, then it should be the case that where princes or local regimes supported the Reformation, it should succeed. But we find actually that's quite variable. Many princes that supported it or cities that supported it in some cases that reform failed to take hold in those places. Likewise, in some places where rulers opposed it, it took hold anyway. So while we thought that political regime variables or political patronage should explain some of the success, it's not explaining all of it. Another puzzle that occurred to us was that we know that hundreds of thousands, which is pretty amazing, hundreds of thousands of Protestant pamphlets, or I should say evangelical pamphlets and sermons, were published in the first decade after 1517.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize how amazing that is, and this goes back to our discussion of the printing press and literacy rates. I mean, hundreds of thousands.
Right.
In this period of time, the population of Europe was much smaller then. We would assume that there's much less literacy, but hundreds of thousands of pamphlets at that stage of technology and literacy is just amazing. It's amazing. Mind-blowing.
Yeah, and Luther and the evangelicals were amazing polemicists.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the reasons why there was such a proliferation of these pamphlets is, for one thing, they kept them relatively short. They were very inexpensive. And what was also, I think, also increased their appeal is that they were very well illustrated, usually with woodcut illustrations. Mm-hmm. So we mentioned before that probably about a fifth of urban men were literate. But they didn't limit themselves to only reaching those people. These
right.
pamphlets were interesting to other people. They had interesting images. And since those images were largely biblical, they were familiar to people.
Right, right.
So this was a really incredible campaign. And we know it reached basically every corner of the empire. So if the story of the Reformation is simply one about the universal diffusion of printing, then we should have basically a universal institution of reform, a universal embrace of reform. And that's not true.
Right.
So what we wanted to look at was, in particular, urban reform, and to look at the decades from 1517 through 1545. And those decades are crucial because those are the decades when the evangelical movement was really that, propelled by a social movement. After that period, to a large extent, it was decided by political factors like dynastic wars and wars of religion.
A prince decides what his territory will be, Catholic or Lutheran.
Correct. Or in some cases, a region or a city decides for reform, but is then later invaded by a Habsburg army and the reformers are expelled or executed and the city reverts to Catholicism.
Okay.
So that's a different kind of dynamic than what we're interested in.
So we're talking here for the first three decades of the evangelical reform movement from 1517 to mid-40s.
Correct.
So to speak.
And during that phase, it's predominantly an urban movement and it's predominantly one driven by a social movement, sometimes enjoying the patronage of local political elites or regional rulers, sometimes not, sometimes actually being opposed by them. And we found was that actually we looked at all cities in the Holy Roman Empire, it's about 500 cities, of 2,000 or more population that had privileges of self-government, that is, had the right to decide its own civic constitution or its own civic policies. And we found that about 55% of them accepted the Reformation, accepted reform, and our measure of that is a very unambiguous one. Did that town abolish the Roman Catholic Mass or not?
Mm-hmm.
So about 55% did by the beginnings of these wars of religion. So what we want to understand is what explains the variability in that. So just over half do, but why? And it turns out that yes, there's a correlation between that and the disposition of regional rulers. But it's not a very high correlation. And there's also a correlation between that and other cultural and social structural variables. The size of the town, which is a good measure of economic and commercial development, is correlated. The presence of a printing press is correlated and so on. But what we wanted to see is what explained, beyond these correlations, could we try to identify mechanisms that would explain why the Reformation or evangelical reform triumphed in some places and failed to succeed in others.
Tell me about them.
Well, we tried to think about various factors, and we were interested in two things. First, as you alluded to before, who were the collective actors? So when reform came to reform ideas came to a town, let's say in a pamphlet or something like that, simply because a pamphlet appears and new ideas emerge, That doesn't mean there's going to be a change in the civic constitution of society.
I guess a lot of the townsfolk could consider this to be the initial phase of junk mail and just looked at the pamphlet and moved on.
That's right. I mean, these were pretty stirring ideas, but they had been stirring ideas before.
Right.
There had been heretical and reform ideas which had spread around before, but they hadn't led to lasting institutional changes. So we wanted to know who were the people who were inclined to take up these ideas, commit to this cause, and fight the political struggle it would take to actually institute reform in their towns, which the historian James Tracy has likened to what he called a culture war. In other words, his point was that when these ideas came into a town, and more importantly, were picked up by advocates, people dedicated to their advocacy, a sort of struggle, sometimes a very political struggle, sometimes a violent struggle, but always a cultural struggle, was waged between those people advocating evangelical reform and defenders of orthodoxy, that is, of conventional Roman Catholic practice and teachings.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot was at stake, because if the evangelicals succeeded, the Roman Catholic Church was abolished.
Which is a high-stakes game.
Right, a very high-stakes game, which would lead to the dissolution or secularization of the monasteries, which would lead to often the priests losing their occupations or being, or in many cases, expelled from the towns. And prominent burghers who were closely associated with the Catholic Church, often members of the town council or members of the local patrician elite, would lose their positions, in some cases lose their property. So a lot was at stake. So a real battle's being fought, and we wanted to figure out who were the people who initiated these battles. Who were the people on both sides who were the first ones to try to organize either a reform movement or a counter movement in these towns?
You make a really interesting point there in that it wasn't just a good idea on a pamphlet that motivates people. As you mentioned, there are people with some very entrenched interest here, and that this battle is going to be fought intensely. And the people who take up this battle have to be really motivated. These are going to have to be zealots or, individuals who are really devoted to the cause. So
that's right. And this isn't true not just of the early Reformation, I think, but I think it's true also of the early Christian Church and in the Greco-Roman world. It's true of early phases of the U.S. Civil Rights Movement.
Mm-hmm.
There are many good ideas, for example, in the U.S. Civil Rights Movement. There were many ideas about equality. These were not totally novel ideas. What was novel in the 1950s and early 1960s was putting these ideas into practice, and a series of very specific institutional reforms and practices which were advocated by visible people who modeled the kind of commitment to the cause, who were willing to take up the cause, willing to suffer imprisonment, maybe murder, arrest, other kinds of hardships for the sake of the movement. And the same thing was true in the Reformation. Early evangelical activists often failed miserably, and some were executed. And in fact, we know that in the Habsburg territories in the Netherlands, hundreds of heretics, people embracing one or another evangelical idea, were arrested and executed. And in other regions, others were expelled, lost their occupations, their properties were taken away, and so on. So this was a high stake. This was, the stakes were high, and it required committed people, the kind of people we often call zealots, to really initiate movements in these towns. Now, they didn't do that all on their own. They found allies.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, they looked for allies in the guilds, the artisanal guilds who wanted greater civic control, who were anti-clerical, who resented those privileges of the clergy I mentioned before. Sometimes they found allies among civic reformers, members of the local elite, who had long been hoping to try to gain more control over civic affairs and wanted to reduce the influence of the clergy. And I think they very carefully, evangelical activists in town, very carefully sought out allies and often tried to frame, or as we would nowadays say, frame or position their arguments, embrace rhetorics that were appealing to the civic republicanism or to the ideas of good governance and justice that were already present in the town.
That's interesting. Now, of these people, are you trying to think about, well, if I had to undertake a new reform movement, what kind of people would I go for to get these zealots? Is it going to be the old folks, the farmers? You make an interesting argument here about the actual nature of who these zealots were and where they originated from. Tell us a little bit about that.
So we read entries on the biographical entries on about 400 people who were active in the first phase of this movement, both on the Catholic counter-movement side and in the evangelical movement side. And we found that the evangelical activists tended to be young, in their 20s, tended to be pretty well educated. About 80% had attended universities. And we found that most of them had had some kind of a theological education or experience in ecclesiastic, were familiar with ecclesiastical politics. So what this led us to realize was that the universities had been a kind of nurturing ground for the spread of the evangelical movement. After all, early on, let's say in 1517 through the early 1520s, what we now think of as the origins of the Reformation occurred largely among academics at universities and among relatively high-ranking clerics, high-ranking priests and theologians. It wasn't, you know, while many of these ideas resonated with ordinary people, it was largely a movement of the academics and the universities.
Seems to be a faculty rebellion.
In fact, you could think of what was going on at Wittenberg University and later at Basel University as being a kind of young faculty rebellion. The historian Paul Grendler has likened that, has used that term to liken it to later episodes of that in history. Yeah, there was an element of that. And these young faculty members like Luther and Melanchthon attracted radical young students or radicalized young students to their fold. And what we were able to find by reading a lot in the history of the history of the universities and the history of these early reformers was that the university was a crucial experience for them. That this is the place where they were consciously cultivated by Luther, by Melanchthon, later by and at Basel by Zwingli and his allies to be a kind of cadre, a group of committed activists whose job was to take these ideas of the redeemed gospel and bring them to the towns, particularly their hometowns. Now, many of them turned out to have careers which would span numerous locations, but we found a very common experience was that they would be cultivated as activists to bring the Reformed gospel out into the world, away from the universities and out into the broader world, and that in almost all instances, they were told to target the place they knew best first, that is their own hometown.
They probably knew people that they were linked to either in the guilds or the burghers or even the political structure of the town as well. It makes perfect sense. One of the interesting things about the students as this cadre of individuals going out, you mentioned this in the paper, was that Luther and Melanchthon would teach courses to students of not just, you know, 15 or 20, but they were talking in the neighborhood of 300, 400, 500 students at a time hearing this message, and they're the ones that go out to these villages and cities and the territory. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, so Wittenberg and Basel were two places where the new humanist spirit, the idea that intellectuals and clergymen should learn original biblical languages like New Testament Greek and Hebrew. They should learn these languages for themselves, and they should be engaging the scriptures and writing sermons and speeches and public addresses that engage that literature and came up with new interpretations of it and put it into active use in the reform of towns and the cultural struggles of the day. So at these two universities, this new kind of humanist education was really unleashed for the sake of reforming society, for redeeming the church. And remember, these people really truly believed that they were tasked with not only restoring the church to its original foundations, but really they were engaged in a battle for the soul of European Christendom.
Yeah.
That the soul of Europe was at stake, and that people had to be saved from false practices that were leading them to think that their salvation was assured when in fact it wasn't. So this was going on in the universities, and there was tremendous interest, excitement among those students who were kind of brought into that movement by these young, really dynamic, and probably very charismatic intellectuals.
And it's interesting, too, as you talk about this in the paper. I mean, the students have a certain type of characteristic. I mean, we know, you know, as faculty that are getting older here at the University of Washington, you know, we know our 20-some-year-old students are invulnerable. They seem to have these immense time horizons where they think anything is very possible.
That's right. And also they're less, as social movement scholars have shown in many cases, young people are often the really important early adopters of social movements or the kind of the key shock troops early in the formation movements because they have fewer of the sort of entanglements that make it hard for someone like me to get involved in a radical movement. So you know, if one has a spouse, if one has children, if one has a stable job, one is much less willing to risk all that to get involved in a radical movement whose outcome is very uncertain and participation which could be, you know, very severely punished. Young people have fewer of the kind of impediments to getting involved in a movement like that than older people do.
On top of these university students, these are going to be people coming from wealthier families who, you know, don't have to worry about being on, you know, the farm every day to make sure that the crops come in lest the family die the next day.
That's right. Almost none of these people, there were few, almost none of them were drawn from the social classes which were closest to marginal subsistence.
Right.
Which would have been, this was still an agrarian society, so it would have been either the peasant classes or the urban poor. Very, very few. What did surprise us was, and this is true on the side of the Catholic countermovement as well as the evangelical movement, there were some that were drawn from relatively modest social backgrounds. It's pretty incredible, but pious people in the late 15th and early 16th centuries often gave endowments to cathedral schools or to Latin schools to help people of modest background prepare for careers as priests.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these people were what we would consider scholarship students.
Yeah, financial aid in the medieval era.
Correct. And this ties also connected them closely to their hometowns because, after all, they were they had good connections in their hometown, which was one of the reasons they had gotten the scholarships in the first place. And also they were then often well-connected to local people who were involved in the religious constitution of the town or the civic affairs of the town.
Mm-hmm. Now, so we got this cadre of students that is going out there. Some of them have scholarships. Some of them are you know, from wealthier families. They're listening to Luther. They're listening to Zwingli and all the folks at Wittenberg and Basel. And they're sent out there. I can't imagine that these were the only students involved here. Are there some students on the other side of the coin that were saying, whoa, I don't know if I buy into this new evangelical reform movement?
That's an excellent point. You know, there were 17 universities in the Holy Roman Empire in 1517, which is extraordinary, to me, an extraordinary number of universities, partially because of the kind of decentralization we talked about
right.
before.
And that was a relatively new, I mean, these universities were starting to pop up with greater rapidity in the late 1500s.
Right. That's right.
Late 1400s.
I think about half of that 17 had been founded since 1450.
Right.
And Wittenberg, for example, was a very new university. I think that was founded around 1510.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very new university. So there were a lot more opportunities for higher education study. Now, meanwhile, opportunities for employment in upper levels of the clerical or state administration had not really expanded. So, you know, this is a typical condition favoring rebellion in lots of instances in world history. Lots more people have aspirations to move up in the world, and they have some education and means to do that, but there aren't actually any positions for them to take. There's no there's no corresponding increase in the number of good jobs.
This is absolutely fascinating. Well, so what you're talking about here is essentially a religious glass ceiling.
There was a kind of glass ceiling, right, whether that was in high-level ecclesiastical employment, or whether that was actually in the expanding state administration. The state administration was not expanding as rapidly as university enrollments was. So that was an additional factor. But most of these 17 universities, Professor Kim and I found out, there was very little of this kind of radical religious activity happening. Certainly the people were aware of what was going on and so on. But most university faculties were very conservative, and they tried to clamp down on these kinds of discussions and try to prevent the inroads of evangelical thinking among the students. So we found that actually the vast majority of universities, remember how much uncertainty there was, remember how much danger there was, remember how dangerous it was to be accused of heresy, right? To be accused of heresy would lead to arrest, conviction of heresy could lead to death. So people didn't want to, you know, university faculty and most students did not want to be condemned as heretics. So most actually sat on the sidelines. The interesting thing we found is that most universities and most students didn't join the counter movement. They also sat on the sidelines. There were two universities that we identified as early focal points for the formation of the evangelical movement, we found that there were two universities which were focal points for the formation of Catholic counter movements, of Orthodox movements. And those two were the universities of Cologne, which is located in present-day northwest Germany, and the University of Leuven, which was located in present-day Belgium. Mm-hmm. These were the two universities that where the faculty, kind of contra Luther, contra Zwingli, committed themselves to trying to protect the Catholic Church and defend Orthodoxy. And they purposely cultivated students who would be the kind of shock troops against the spreading evangelical movement. So if these two universities were the ones where students were required to take an oath of loyalty to the Catholic Church and to take an oath of anathema against Luther. That means an oath that committed them to oppose Luther.
Right. And so what we have here is interesting, seeing the everything take shape. Two universities where students are becoming radicalized in the Lutheran evangelical message, or Zwingli in the Switzerland, and then these other two universities where the Catholic Church was fighting back. And your evidence, as you look at this, shows that, you know, where these students end up had a great deal of impact in the first 30 years on whether you tip one way to the Reformed movement or stayed Catholic in the other direction.
That's correct. So you can think of an image like, sort of in terms of an imagery, you might think of two contending social networks are being formed.
Right.
One of evangelical activists, one of Orthodox activists. And what we argued was that these two groups, to varying extents across towns, clashed in this culture war I talked about before going on in the towns. So these two networks clashed as each side tried to organize a political response to the crisis. The evangelicals were looking for political allies, supportive princes, or supportive members of the town council to try to institute reform. On the other hand, you have an Orthodox counter-movement trying to prevent that. And our measures show that the more exposed a town was to the evangelical network relative to the Orthodox network, the greater its odds of adopting reform, of abolishing the Mass. And conversely, the more exposed it was to the Catholic counter-movement and the less exposed to the evangelical movement, the greater the odds of its retaining the Mass.
I want to talk about that, because this is one of the most fascinating parts of the paper, one of the things that I really love about your research, not only this project, but since Steve is at the same university that I work at, I will occasionally cross the quad and visit him. And on more than one occasions, I will see him sitting in his office. He's working on his maritime mutiny book, with his research, with these old, musty books, just tracking down these, you know, individuals of what ship they were located on. And this, in essence, is what you did with the data here.
That's right. What Professor Kim and I did was we were able to identify matriculation lists. So how do we know? So the question is, how do we know how tied towns or cities were to these various university networks? So we were able to get a complete matriculation list, which is pretty remarkable. A complete matriculation list for 14 out of 17 of these universities, which yielded about 20,000 discrete entries, 20,000 students. Mm-hmm. And these matriculation lists provide the place of origin of students. So we could reconstruct the network, or we could draw an inference about the network that linked towns and universities through these matriculations, but we only looked at a particular period during the formation of these early cadre. So we looked at matriculations at these universities, from 1517 to 1522. Mm-hmm. So we were able to measure the effect of all university enrollments on a town, which we found was statistically insignificant when other factors were controlled for, and the specific effect of the Orthodox versus the evangelical networks for that period, for the students enrolled in that period, 1517 to 1522. So we argued that was the period when there was these distinct cadres were being formed. And those were the networks we were interested in.
And then from 1522, these folks are going out, they're spreading out, and it just connects. I mean, for me, this is absolutely fascinating. And when we think of earlier histories of the Reformation, oftentimes these are couched in very broad-term sociological movements. What's so great about your work here is that you're looking at the micro foundations, and you get into this data. These books are sitting out there of lists of students, where they came from, and just to go through this, it's just a wealth of information that we think might be somewhat useless. I mean, you could think of today a historian some 50 years in the future looking at enrollments at the University of Washington or at Baylor and tracking where everybody is going. The effort to put into this is truly Herculean. And, I think the profession really needs to thank you to fill in these micro foundations of what is actually going on. And to see the I guess, also after all this work, to see the fruition of your work saying, yeah, these networks really matter, this must be incredibly rewarding.
It is rewarding. I mean, I think you're right. We're at a stage right now where We have a lot of great historical accounts of the Reformation.
Right.
And they tend to be of particular regions or principalities, or in some cases, case studies of a couple or a few cities. But there's very few studies that look at the entire region with a lot of observations. That's mm-hmm. very uncommon. We also have a lot of great, really pioneering theoretical work about the Reformation that's trying to come up with some, informed by general theory, trying to come up with some theoretical generalizations about the origins of the Reformation and its consequences. Think, for example, of the work of Rodney Stark or Robert Eklund or Larry Iannacone, who have written. And then you can think, look, there's a lot of great ideas about this. What we've been lacking up to now, in my view, are convincing tests of those theories. Because mm-hmm. to test those theories effectively, you really need to build large data sets, which have a lot of observations across all these different kinds of political units, across different regions, with measures of these various structural factors we talked about, economic measures and social measures and cultural measures and so on.
And network measures, which is an incredibly daunting task to think about. You can only imagine a lot of scholars would say, ooh, that's a lot of work. And we get the profession owes you a great deal of thanks to actually dig this stuff out.
Well, it's all there. You know, that's the thing. This required no primary source material work on our part. That is to say, we didn't go to any archives. We were able to get all the information we needed from existing sources, most of them in German, so you do need, it does help to know research language, which I do. Most of them in German, most of them available through interlibrary loan, and we got a lot of help here from the University of Washington's mm-hmm. excellent interlibrary loan department in tracking down all these matriculation lists, which were in the rare book rooms of many German libraries, and which they were able to convince their counterparts in Germany to mail to us as photocopies and PDF, so we were really fortunate. There was a little bit of work I did at the UCLA Rare Books Room for some excellent political maps to really make careful coding of the political variables, the territorial variables. So yes, that's what we really need to do. And because we were able to do all that, and I think other historians of people who want to do macro comparative sociological macro historical studies of religion should try to do this too. We really need to make use of new source materials to get at these debates. I mean, a proliferation of case studies of this or that town is not really going to do that. And more theories about what's going on without much evidence is not really going to advance a state of knowledge. We really need to bring together evidence and theory really in novel ways to do that. And building data sets like the one that Professor Kim and I have done is really vital to that goal.
And that is, again, as I will emphasize to our listeners who may not be familiar with the research process, that even though some of this comes from secondary resources or we now have the benefit of interlibrary loan, that's a lot of hard work, and it's takes
been
a
about,
lot of time.
Yeah, it's been about, I guess it's been around 7 years of work.
Wow.
And I should say also that we were assisted by a lot of undergraduate student assistants who helped with the matriculation lists. Those are generally in medieval church Latin. So we were able to come up with using a Microsoft Access, we were able to create a database of Latin place names with the help of excellent source from the University of Columbia Library, a Latin place name dictionary. They had digitized that. We were able to put that into an Access file with two other Latin place name dictionaries. So this made it very easy for undergraduate students to work with us because they could type in the Latin name and that would give them matches. And then where there was any ambiguity, we worked on it together to try to resolve that. So combination of research tools that made it easier for undergraduates mm-hmm. to work with us, didn't require them to know Latin, and so a little bit of modern, some technical innovation combined with existing source materials made it easier to do it.
New technological tools are giving us ways to look at old data in new ways.
Right, and I want to say one other thing about the virtues of doing this kind of what you could call social science history. And that is, we found the statistical evidence we were able to put together not only found support for our argument about the diffusion effects of these students, I think that's pretty clear, and pretty robust to inclusion of a lot of different variables and different ways of arranging the models, but also it confirmed a lot of existing arguments, and that's important.
And this is something that you're working on now. This paper that you've written with Professor Kim is not the end-all and be-all of your work on the Reformation. Tell us a little bit about what you're working on and testing now.
So we found a lot of... So in addition to our support for our hypothesis about the role of student networks, We also found in our analysis a lot of support for the political regime's argument, political patronage argument, that says essentially that the odds of reform success should be greater where local rulers provided patronage or some kind of support to reform. We found that was very robust. It doesn't explain all the variants, but it is an important predictor.
Mm-hmm.
Our preferred explanation, the hypothesis about the students, retains significance in the presence of those variables, and they retain presence in retain their significance in the presence of our preferred explanation. So I would say that it's additive. Yes, political regimes and political interests matter. That's clearly supported by our research, but so too does this diffusion hypothesis also find support. So now that we have this wonderful data set, it also allows us to open up other debates, to explore other debates about the Reformation. So, for example, the work of Robert Eklund and his associates has been very important to think about the economics of the late medieval Catholic Church and the ways in which those economics opened the door to the Reformation. So what I'm beginning to do now, working with a graduate student here at the University of Washington named Katie Corcoran, what we're beginning to do now is to seek out measures of various kinds of economic indicators of the strength of the Catholic Church in local economic markets and see how that influences a net of political and student variables, whether how that influences the likelihood of reform in a town.
Now, I know you're just getting underway in this and you're going through the data and analyzing it, but any results popping up right now that you could give us a little hint on?
So one of the really provocative, interesting ideas, there are many provocative, interesting ideas in Eklund and his associates' two books, Sacred Trust and The Marketplace of Christianity. But some of them have to do with their arguments about the economic vitality. They argue that the most economically vital cities should be the most prone to reform because emerging economic elites should have wanted to break up the Roman Catholic religious monopoly because their argument that it was economically inefficient and imposed costs that could have imposed costs and drew resources that could have been better used for economic development or other purposes. So one thing we found is there's partial support for their argument that the more commercially advanced trading towns do seem to be more likely, net of many controls, to have instituted reform. They also argued that the local strength of the Catholic Church in terms of its ability to dominate local markets, its ability to supply all the religious demand in a market, should have been a barrier to Protestant entry. In other words, the basic argument is that if you have a monopoly firm that completely saturates a local market and can mm-hmm. do so at any price, that should provide basically barriers to entry for any
very
rival religious
wall.
Firm.
Right.
Right. So one of the ways, and a proxy for that, they argued, was the size of cathedrals.
Mm-hmm.
So their argument was the larger Catholic churches or cathedrals in an area, the more the entire population or the greater fraction of the population could be included in its walls at one time, which is a proxy for how economically resourceful it was, the kind of resources that the church could bring to bear. So we have actually measured on a subset of these cities, about 260 of these cities, we've measured that variable and we've tested this idea, and it doesn't seem to have any significant effect net of with population included in the same model.
Hmm.
So the effect of large church size it's very high. Church size is very highly correlated with the population size and commercial development of a town.
Right.
So larger, richer towns have bigger churches. So that partially washes out the effect of church size. And then when we add the political regime variables, the effect disappears. However, they also talked a lot about some really interesting other factors. For example, they talked about how well the Catholic Church was meeting the demands of local consumers. So we have been able to, it's pretty extraordinary, again, these data exist, they just haven't been used systematically, we've been able to measure the number of monastic houses present in every one of these 260 towns in our subsample. And we can break that down by whether they were monastic cloistered orders versus mendicant orders, that is, orders that get out of the monastery to serve the public, like the Dominicans, the Franciscans, and so on.
Right.
And we find some very interesting effects there. We find that those variables do seem to influence. So the larger the size of the monastic cloistered, it seems like, the larger, the more advanced, these are preliminary results, but the larger, more more developed the cloistered monastic communities, the lower the odds of reform. And the more developed the mendicant, we could call that adherent-serving side of the religious economy, mm-hmm. the greater the odds of reform. So what we're trying to figure out is, why would that be? Is that because the Catholic Church was saw places that were prone to reform or where there was a lot of religious dissatisfaction and so deployed those monks there to either, in the case of Dominicans, to fight back against heretical thoughts, or in the case of Franciscans, to provide services to neglected adherents who may mm-hmm. have been looking for an alternative? Or was it because, actually, the presence of those services increased expectations in towns about what the church should do? And since those mendicants were only a small portion of all clerics,
right.
people may have been overall very satisfied with what the Franciscans were doing, but said, why is that? But what the Franciscans do is quite right, but why is that such a small proportion of all the clerics in our town?
And so in many ways, the town was pump prime for these, you know, students that come in saying,
precisely.
Hey, this is a more do-it-yourself kind of church.
Right. Or why shouldn't we have a church which is more responsive to local needs? Why is it answering to needs somewhere else? Why does it have so many clerics and monasteries who are not serving the world? Why does it have so many priests who are on wealthy endowments and who don't even bother to really give their own sermons anymore, don't even bother to celebrate their own masses anymore, but pay a subordinate to do that, right? These Franciscans do it. Why can't everybody do it? Mm-hmm. It could be that's what's going on. And finally, another thesis, which I'm just beginning to work on, is a really provocative thesis by a great social historian and cultural historian named Lionel Rotkrug. And he had a provocative thesis. He noticed he noticed a very strong correlation in the 1980s. The greater the extent of the cult of the saints in a town,
right,
the less prone it was to reform. His argument being that the more that the Catholic Church was involved in the imminent everyday life of communities, through lots of ritual practices, through veneration of saints, through the organization of civic rituals around shrines, the more attached people were to the Catholic Church, the more relevant they saw it was to everyday life. Where the cult of the saints was less advanced, he argued, there was more of an idea of a transcendental God who was not as connected to these specific Catholic practices, but like the Virgin Mary or Jesus, was the guardian and protector of all. He thought in those regions, evangelical ideas may have been more appealing because they argued that God was more universal,
right,
and that one could reorganize civic practices in ways which were consistent with these universal, transcendental, more abstract religious ideas. So this was a really provocative idea, and he came up with a lot of explanations for it. In many ways, his arguments I don't think were very precise, but it's a brilliant insight. So one of the things I'm going to be able to do in future work is test that, because Rotkrug, in appendices to his work, provides a systematic list of every saint, Marian, and Christ shrine in every town in Germany and Austria from the period 1200 to 1550.
That is a rich data source.
That's a rich data source, but he did not engage in any kind of multivariate analysis. He only used that data to show a correlation.
Right.
So what we'll be able to do is to say, does that correlation really survive when other variables are introduced? Is that effect of those shrines still found when we add in the kind of economic variables identified by Eklund and Stark, the kind of political economy variables suggested by your own work or by the work of Stark and Swanson and others? Does it hold up when we control for those economic factors?
Mm-hmm.
Then we'll be able to see.
That's kind of interesting. We're going to have to check back with you on that work, that the data sources that you're finding here that are just like gold nuggets just sitting on the ground that you're picking up is really interesting.
I would liken it more to strip mining. That is to say, I wish it were true that the gold nuggets were just laying around on the ground, one could go about and pick them up. It's actually more like strip mining. You have to move an enormous amount of scholarly material to find those few nuggets of gold.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the reasons why this work is extremely time-consuming, because it takes a long time to identify all these data sources, to assemble them, and often they're not organizing comprehensive lists. One has to build the list oneself from a variety of sources. So I wish it were true that the rich seams of ore are there, but in many cases they're buried, and it takes a lot of scholarly work to get at them. And we're fortunate as social scientists that historians have done such a wonderful and thorough job of documenting their arguments, documenting their sources, which allows us to, you know, as you said before, go through the footnotes and follow back to the original source. Or we are able to find those historians who did try to be really comprehensive and provide general lists.
Well, Steve, this is absolutely fascinating. We're going to have to check back with you on further episodes of the podcast to see how that work is progressing. The service that you provide to illuminate some of these unseen factors that have led to the spread of the Reformation in the early 16th century is absolutely fascinating. I want to thank you for being on the show. And for our listeners, if you want to participate in the conversation or follow a few links to Steve's work and a few other references that we made here, please check out our website at www.researchonreligion.org. We look forward to talking to you next week. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for including me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.